Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market. Whether you are cooking for one or for a crowd, Fairway Market literally has everything you need for a fantastic meal. But if you don't feel like cooking, no worries. They cater. Check out fairwaymarket.com for more information, and be sure to check the new blog, On Our Plate, for weekly specials, health tips, and recipes.
Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.com.
Yes, we're yet again burning down the house. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, here in a frosty February. Today we're going to speak about quality with Professor Dr. Wilfred Wang, who was with us previously, and we were trying to get towards a definition of quality, quality in architecture. Lots of people have tried to define quality or to qualify quality. I had suggested that one way to identify quality was to look at the experiments of the Wiener Werkstätte in the early 20th century and late 19th century, which of course comes out of the notion of Gesamtkunstwerk, which starts with Wagner. But Dr. Wang wasn't so keen on identifying the Wiener Werkstätte as quality. Jack, our engineer, is dialing him up right now. Wilfred will be joining us through the marvels of telecommunication from Berlin, where he mostly has his home base when he's not teaching at University of Texas in Austin. So Jack, I guess you're doing the dialing. And he's getting Dr. Wang on the phone. Quality, as defined by Robert Persig, or as attempted to be defined by Robert Persig in his seminal work, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Well, you know, if you've ever read that or tried to read that, after about 438 pages, Persig finally decides that quality is a metaphysical proposition and that to qualify quality requires almost a leap of faith that quality exists as something beyond definition. It is something from which all reality flows. I don't think we're going to get into that as an architectural construct. I see that Jack is dialing. Jack will let me know when we're ready to speak with Dr. Wang. Dr. Wang, aside from teaching at UT, is also the former director of the Deutsches Architekturmuseum in Frankfurt, the German Architectural Museum, which I think is a wonderful idea. Here in the United States, of course, we have the Building Museum in Washington, D.C., which is a wonderful structure. If you're in the East Coast, I recommend that you get down there. I hear a little background hum. Are we close to a connection? Good afternoon, Doctor.
Good afternoon.
I'm so glad that we found you. Thank you for taking time out of your busy day to talk with us.
Yes, I'm happy to be able to assist.
Are you in a comfortable place where you can speak?
Yes.
Okay, there's a little bit of a delay, but that's all right. We can manage that. When last we spoke, I was hoping to find from you the result of your research into quality in architecture, which is an elusive topic.
Indeed it is. But it's actually not so difficult because it encompasses a number of physical facts as well as a number of contextual facts. And if you can identify these facts, then I think you have a way of talking about quality.
I had earlier, in our earlier discussion, suggested that perhaps combining many different elements of expression together was a path towards achieving quality, and I had suggested that perhaps the Wiener Werkstätte approach was a path towards quality, but I sensed that you found that their work was too pictorial and decorative.
Well, I think there's a general question about the role of context and heritage and tradition and the role that innovation plays. And I think if you insist on too much innovation for the sake of innovation, as to some extent Wiener Werkstätte did, then you run the risk of disconnecting yourself from tradition and from context. So the really tricky question in terms of the context, and the context is both the immediate physical context as well as the cultural historical context, is what is the ideal balance? To what extent can one push the boundary, and to what extent does one need to adhere to certain historical facts?
Without going too far and becoming, for example, in the United States, postmodern, yes?
Well, postmodern was one way of trying to retrieve the context, although the context had long been lost. So there is another difficulty in that respect. Modernism having destroyed a lot of the cultural roots meant that in many cases you are trying to invent something that no longer had a context. So, you know, especially in Germany and in some cases a part of the United States, there is no there anymore.
Correct.
So, you know, the problem about destruction during the Second World War and destruction of the downtowns in the United States was that you really had just tabula rasa, and to what were you going to respond?
So what do we find that in the United States the growth of universally applied corporate construction, where you go to one part of the United States, you don't know where you are because there is no longer a local vernacular, has destroyed very large swath of a regional expression. So what are we to do? How do we create quality if there is no context that remains?
Well, one more general question is, what are the essential aspects of any form of settlement design? And then you can say, are there archetypes? Mm. And if there are archetypes, say, in the agricultural area, such as farms, farm buildings, or are there, in more dense settlement structures, are there ideal forms of living together, i.e., to what extent should an inner city be a dense set of buildings, or to what extent should it be a set of individual objects? And I think that there are some clear differences in urban design issues which will point towards, depending on the climatic condition, but in most cases would point towards a denser form of settlement structure in urban conditions. How that then looks in terms of subdivision of individual lots, and individual building typologies is part of a more general question of how we want to live. But if you're asking about a kind of condition where nothing is left, and what do you invent, you ask yourself about the living conditions and the aspirations that you have for the next generations or two, and how buildings should adapt to suit that particular lifestyle.
Yes, well, I'm agreeing with you so far, but then we come to the excesses of individual, artistic, formalistic expression that seem to ignore the human condition of certain innate preferences for light over dark, or daylight over artificial light, or perhaps even along accustomed through familiarity, happiness being in an orthogonal structure instead of one that is racked or has no perceived structural integrity when you look at it. What to make of these things?
Well, you know, I mean, some of the most visually satisfying and culturally coherent places are those that use the same, where the buildings use this same palette of materials, colors, and building typologies, whether it's alpine villages or cities like London and Paris, where you know that there are certain building types like the Georgian terrace houses or the apartment buildings of Paris, which repeat in different variations, but in essence along very similar lines, so that you end up with a very strong coherence, even though there are subtle variations or greater variations over centuries. And it's that kind of coherence which strong individualism obviously doesn't respect, and that's where we get a big problem with contemporary architecture and urban design.
I myself am constantly battling with architects and designers who strongly insist that to restrain themselves from making a jarring or shocking formal expression is to be somehow endorsing the status quo, which is sick.
Yeah, so I think that's one general misunderstanding as to where architecture and urban design should be. On the one hand, I think the general public has both the expectation and the right to insist that there must be some form of consensus about what buildings should look like. And on the other hand, of course, there is the freedom of expression of the individual designer and client. But that should not go, that should not be a blank check, especially if you're working within a given context, whether it's a village or whether it's a city. I think the idea that you should be able to do anything you like is completely abrogating any responsibility in the education of a child. That doesn't lead you to bring up a child in a responsible way. The same thing applies to architecture and urban design.
Well,
you can't have a free-for-all.
I agree. But given that, to whatever extent there is an academy, shall we say, presently, and the academy seems to be informed by the by architectural publications that feature very pretty images that may not be good buildings, I'm at a loss as to how we come to a consensus on one hand, and how we can educate the public as to what is what we believe to be good in terms of context, tradition, good use of materials and of archetypes. How do we bring that about?
Well, I think that if you take the basic idea of a bridge, any design is a form of a bridge as a metaphor. You're taking something from a current context, and hopefully you're establishing something that will have some lasting value into the next decades and maybe even the next century. So building has to act as a bridge to the future, but it also has to act as a bridge to the past. And therefore, the difficulty lies in constructing that very connection between past, present, and future. You have to be able to read the flexibility of a building and its typology in terms of its ability to accommodate things that you may not know might happen in the future.
Uh-huh.
So that's a kind of general notion. At the same time, more specifically, the building has to respond to a context. And in the same way as it responds to the context in typological terms, i.e. the way it functions on the inside, it has to work in representational terms on the exterior. It has to make a connection to the existing fabric. And at the same time, it probably also needs to project itself from the future, however that future is. And that's the interpretation of the designer.
Interesting, yes. Well, so, in a way, what you're suggesting is, in a way, true to the ideals of Orthodox modernism.
Well, Orthodox modernism in general, that's the academic interpretation. It's not necessarily every modernist's interpretation, but what was handed down in schools was that history is bad. History has to be ignored, and history is the past and it's dead. As opposed to my understanding that history is everything that we've built, including the buildings of the last year. So there's a notion of continuity, and that continuity needs to be taken into the future and not just be regarded as something that has served its purpose.
Yeah, I was specifically reacting to the notion of projecting a future path based on the imagination or predictive efforts of the designer as to how this building carries ideas forward into the future, which is perhaps not modernism but futurism.
Well, how can I put it? I mean, people who designed lofts in the 19th century for storing objects that, you know, they didn't know what might happen in 10, 15 years' time, certainly didn't have any ideas about lofts being used as apartments or offices 100 years later, and that happened. So they didn't create futuristic buildings. They created buildings that had kind of an expression that, in some cases, referred to classicism, etc. When you have buildings designed by Erich Mendelssohn or Zaha Hadid, those buildings are quintessentially futuristic. Now, I'd say that in the case of Erich Mendelssohn, his internal typology is more along the lines of the way that those builders constructed the lofts of the 19th century. And therefore, Erich Mendelssohn's buildings are more flexible and more adaptable and more suitable for future uses, whereas Zaha's buildings are probably highly specific. And that's fundamentally the difference between certain kinds of building tasks, whether they're public cultural buildings or whether they are more general offices and apartments or storage buildings. So you can compare the tasks, you can compare the context, and you can look at architects' work and make judgments according to whether something is more of a bridge in metaphorical terms, both in terms of its internal workings as well as in terms of its representational ability. That's how I would make a judgment about architectural and urban design qualities.
Could you restate that? Yes.
Yeah. To what extent is there a bridge function that makes a connection to the past, satisfies the present, and allows things to happen in the future?
That's good. That you made a point in one of your lectures. I'm not sure if you mentioned this when you were in New York at the Deutsches Forschung or in some lecture that I saw of yours on YouTube. But you talked about the stadium in Portugal. It was a very beautiful expression of concrete, but it wasn't a good stadium because the ends were not defined, and so therefore, you said that there was an interview with a soccer player, and they asked him what it was it like to make that goal, and he said nothing happened because I just kept running, and no one noticed that a goal had been made.
Right.
Yeah. So. I mean, how do we balance between the world of runway architecture that appears in the press and everyone says, "Oh, what a high quality building it is because it photographs so well," but then it's not really satisfactory for its use and therefore not of quality.
Well, I'm a very good friend of Eduardo Substimura, who designed the football stadium, and I made the criticism before it was constructed. And he said, well, you know, this is an idea that he was trying to pursue. Sometimes even good friends can't be of any use in terms of their criticism because the architect has such an authority. He's respected by clients and others so much that nothing will change his mind. I think that's also a failure of the role of the client, frankly. But with regard to the football stadium specifically, what is the main problem of the stadium is not so much its structure, which is a beautiful concept. The problem is that it doesn't have an atmosphere. A football stadium needs to have an atmosphere of like a pressure cooker. And if it doesn't have that, you don't get an excitement amongst the players or the people who are watching the match. So that, I think, is a clear qualitative failure, which Sudamura doesn't really care about because he doesn't go to football matches, he says. nevertheless, you know, you can't allow, I don't think, architects just to pursue their particular ideas about structure if it means that one of the quintessential qualities of a building isn't satisfied. And so, you know, you can... I mean, you can spend millions and millions and then realize that it's a mistake. I think that's too late. Therefore, I think what one needs, even with good architects, is a strong sense of responsibility on behalf of the client. And if the client can't talk to the architect, then he needs to find a way by which to talk to the architect, whether it's a set of advisors or a design review board or whatever.
That's interesting. So... What I'm learning or hearing from you is that one path towards quality is to be true to the use typology of the intended structure.
Right.
To let the morphology follow the typology, so that its use is well served, and let and let the formal decisions flow from that conformance to the desirable aspects of what's it for.
Right. But it's not just the internal runnings, it's not the internal typology, it's also the representation. Many of the buildings today are very factual, rationalistic objects, quite cold and brutal, and they've lost any sense of representation. You sometimes find it difficult to know where the entrance is because it's, you know, such a regular structure. And that's part of the heritage of modernism. It denied representational aspects. So we need to get back to some notion of where, how we actually design fronts, backs, sides, entrances, honorific spaces, foyer spaces.
But doesn't that lead us in? Doesn't that lead us into the pitfalls of semiotics?
Of course it does. But you know, you can make architecture. We can, shall we say, construct buildings, but it's not architecture.
Right.
It's just construction. It's just keeping elements together and without any sense of propriety. And that's what I'm fundamentally talking about, that everything that you look at, whether it's a car or whether it's a mug or whatever, it has an expression of what its purpose is, how to find the front door of a car, how to use a mug, how to, in the end, find an entrance to a building.
Right.
And once you're in a building, that you know where the main staircase is, where the elevators are. Right. I mean, these things are so obvious that it really is not even worth talking about. But there are some buildings, take for instance hospitals, where it's very difficult to find your way around.
Yes.
Right? So why should that be? Why do we accept that?
Oh, even in the case
of a machine?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, the new Museum of Modern Art campus in New York City totally fails in terms of wayfinding. Because you have to go over to the corner to get on escalators, and each floor looks like the next, and you have no idea where you are.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a particular problem of modern architecture. It's a particular problem of institutions that keep on growing, like airports, like hospitals. And why should it be so difficult, especially when you are in these huge buildings, to find your way around? So that's what I mean by representation and honorific issues. You should be able to, as an architect, make clear where the main routes are. And if you fail to do that, then you're not really an architect. Then you're a constructor, an engineer, or a builder. But you're not designing.
Yeah, this,
designing is to do with designating meaning. Where is the main entrance? Where is the main route? Where is the main staircase?
I agree. It brings to mind the bewildering pavilion, underground pavilion that's under the pyramid at the Louvre. Once you arrive, and the Louvre is very linear. It's bilateral, but it's linear. And when you arrive in that space, there are signs that tell you Denon is over here, and so but you have no idea of directionality because it's symmetrical in four ways, and it gives no relationship to the museum at greater length whatsoever.
Right. So one architect who used the modern language to express main entrance, main route, main staircase was Alvar Aalto. He didn't use neoclassical compositional techniques. His buildings are generally asymmetric, but you know, because of the double or triple height ceiling, this is the foyer. And when the double height ceiling continues, you know that that's the main route to something else. And when the roof lifts, or when the staircase announces itself with the first treads, you know, well, there it is, the main staircase. It's not done with axes or symmetries. It's done with viewing corridors, spatial and volumetric differentiations.
That's a great. That's absolutely,
you know,
yes.
So you can have a modern expression, and yet make it quite clear what the components are. I'm not saying you have to return to neoclassicism. Far from it.
Well, in some ways, neoclassical buildings are bewildering, also, because because a referential to a religious rite of a few thousand years ago that we have lost all contact with.
Right.
Yeah. I do appreciate your being able to spend some time with us. This is meaty stuff, and this is important stuff. I'm very positively impressed by by your thinking, and I do appreciate the time that you've been able to spend with us today.
I'm very happy to spend it with you.
Very good. I hope that when you are next in New York, you can come out and spend a little time here in the studio.
Very good.
And speak some more. We'll be in touch, and I thank you very, very much, and have a good February.
Yes, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.